They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
They're trying to debate who's less racist.
It's a trap.
Welcome to Trap News. The news of the trap, where every 4 years the population is duped. I'm your host, Robert Solster. It's hitting the fan globally. US citizens are once again asked to choose between Coke and Pepsi. They got a right-wing candidate and a fascist businessman, a doctor, another white guy, but we know who will win. This election, we heard a lot of revolution talk, but revolution comes from the people, not a ballot box. Don't you remember? You voted for change, all you got was more wars. Now they're offering far less and claim to deserve your vote. We face a climate catastrophe, mass economic terror. Cops killed more blacks in 2015 than the height of the lynching era. ISIS is on the march from failed wars in the Middle East. Let's check in with Donald Trump, see what he got to say. White workers of the world, I am your voice. I'm the only one on the planet who understands your plight. Believe me, I'm the only one who can fix everything. You want a blonde in every arm, a bomb for every Muslim. I will stand up to scum, the women, the Mexicans, when we make America great again.
Yes, we clear.
Build that wall.
Kill them all.
We're gonna knock down a mosque and build a mall. I will walk the fine line between Mussolini and Berlusconi. Everybody loves me, the KKK, even Nazis. We don't need NATO, let them eat their baguettes. We don't need them to stop the radical Islamic terrorists. They won't even say the word. Should we nuke them? She offers you Benghazi. I bring you solutions.
Well, that's disconcerting, terrifying to say the least. Let's go live to our other right-wing candidate. Listen to his words. He's lost his mind or something. Unlike him, I'm promising absolutely nothing. Heard enough Trump's playing in time to shatter the glass ceiling. Do you want someone who can get shit done or a failed businessman? I get shit done. The Clinton Foundation peddling access to the state for private corporations. I'm JP Morgan Chase approved to make power moves. We'll let the Second Amendment people handle you. You're not the law and order candidate, Donald. Don't you know me and my husband practically wrote the new Jim Crow? I label black super predators, brought the three strikes rule. Under the Clinton dynasty, prison populations boom. You're a racist and a fascist if you don't vote for me. It's time to let a real woman lead. Hillary, you must be talking about me. Jill Stein, candidate of the Green Party. I'm down with the shit, got the arrest record to prove it. I'm the next dead end on the road to revolution. If Donald Trump wins, it'll be all your fault. The only reason you're the candidate is cause the system's rigged. Don't even get me started on election fraud. The DNC, Arizona, Brooklyn, shall I go on? Nobody likes you, you're Pol Pot in a pantsuit. You never do a motherfucking thing for working people. All you promise is more imperial wars and poverty. All that may be true, but at least we got Bernie. Remember me, suckers, I got you pumped for revolution. All we got to show for it, fucking lines on a platform. Hillary stole the primary, but I can't complain. I'm with the workers, I'm a third home, I'm like Champlain. I never talked much about my foreign policy plan, but if I was Lord of the Drones, the Middle East would feel the burn. I channeled all your money and hopes into the system. You wanted a revolution? Haha, you got Clinton. Democracy, what a steaming pile of shit. Doesn't matter who wins the election, the Pentagon always gets in. History explains you can't reform a broken thing.
Thank
Don't
you.
Believe me. Let's hear from Mr. Hope and Change.
I went from a new hope to attack of the drones. Why? I'm Anakin when it comes to ravaging sand peoples and blasting their homes. We're hashing the last chapter and the actions are known, cause you'll spell war orphan with a capital O. We've a sequel to The Farce Awakens, and it's hard to make the statement that I brought you hope and change when it's more like product placement. And for those undocumented patriots, I thank you for your patience, but I'll deport you faster than iPhone 7 cases. I gave you DACA. Well, at least that's better than nada. I see you dreamers, but did you read the dreams of our fathers? U.S. doesn't want less, let's get more. Keep trade open like get more. Fake ass, I'm okay to get awards, but I'll make it okay to get votes.
Thanks to the Muslim chief, white people are being hunted in the streets. I'm gonna build a wall,
and Mexico's gonna pay for
and
it.
If Hillary's elected president, she'll cut off all our penises.
Come again, mate? That makes no sense.
It's the feminization of America. Tell him, Alex.
Alex Jones here, the one who exposed the New World Order. NAFTA was an NWO plot to destroy the border. Fluoride in the water, ruining young men's lives. Hillary gets in, we'll be breastfeeding and cooking for our wives. Donald Trump, he's the real deal, folks. He's the only one that can stand up to the fascism of the left with their politically correct safe space. Bible, George Soros funds Black Lives Matter terrorists.
Alex Jones, what happened to you? How did it come to this? How'd you go from prison planet to promoting an actual fascist?
This is the real spirit of 76. Make America great again for the white race.
You criticize Nazi Germany, but Nazis support this dude.
Well, Nazis like ice cream. Does Hillary want to take that too?
Why do you reckon you get so much love from racists?
You mean patriots?
No, I mean 3%ers who want to bring back slavery.
We need to get off Obama's plantation. It's either white genocide or we bring back the Constitution.
I'm losing brain cells engaging this fool, A.O. Stim.
What up?
You know what to do.
You have to pick the lesser of two evils, Ben, and it's
and after all is said and done, what's really been accomplished? Will the winner of this contest do anything to stop global warming? How many hours did you spend watching? How much money in total was donated for your so-called revolution? If that's not a waste, then what isn't? What if that time was spent organizing in the area that you live in instead of Obamacare, which was a private insurance handout? What if you put your money into self-funded healthcare co-ops? Has anything worthwhile been won through presidential campaigns? Civil rights, the abolition of slavery, the 8-hour work day, can voting ever give us freedom? What's a democracy in the era of mass corporate media? Statistically speaking, wouldn't you have more influence passing out flyers downtown than to vote in an election? Did voting for Kennedy stop the Vietnam invasion? Do you really think the next president can put an end to racist policing? Did having a black president erase systematic racism? Isn't it a function of white supremacy that people of color in leadership positions? And when they say they'll fix the economy, what does that mean? With a job coming back in a massive pyramid scheme? And how much does the economy really matter if by the end of the century every major city is underwater? How can anyone say it's the pinnacle of civic duty when it accomplishes next to nothing time after time? It's been proven. Would we be talking about the cops were not for Ferguson? The better to beg for crumbs or to take direct action? If all you do is vote, you can't complain. It's clear if you really want to change everything, start anywhere.
Today, we have Matthew Lyons, longtime anti-fascist writer. He's going to be talking about the rise of the far right in the U.S., Trump, white nationalism, and in general, fascism. We feel like this is a really important thing to talk about right now. As we speak, Trump is going to be taking office in a matter of days. We're going to try to crank this thing out as fast as we can to really get the juices flowing, get people thinking. We don't really know what's going to happen. We do know that here it's going down. We've gotten a ton of hate mail from everybody from militia types to red hats to meme frog fucks and all these other pieces of shit. Fuck you. We're still doing what we're doing. We don't give a fuck. We're still here. We're getting stronger. Every day we get more powerful. Every day there's more people realizing that we're not funded by George Soros. We're not part of the Democrats. And we certainly ain't with this Trump regime right now that's going on, that wants to create a Muslim registry. It wants to attack unions. It wants to attack everybody that isn't with the reactionary far-right program that's going to make the rich richer, that's going to make America great again for the billionaires out there. Fuck that. So for everybody taking to the streets that's getting ready to disrupt J20, no matter where you are, if you're in D.C., whether you're in bumfuck nowhere, this goes out to you. So this is a great podcast. Please think about it. Think about these things that we're talking about. Get at us. If you enjoy It's Going Down, if you want to see us grow, please help us. Go on to itsgoingdown.org. Sign up to become a monthly subscriber. Sustain us. Sustain our work. Help us grow. Subscribe to us on social media. Things are just starting. Every day, more and more people are cluing into us. They're finding about us for the first time, and we're growing. We need your help to do that. Let's do it together. It's not about us as individuals. It's about us as a movement. Stronger together. Choosing sides, getting organized, itsgoingdown.org. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get to it. Matthew Lyons, three-way fight. Check it out. Okay, so we're joined here today with Matthew Lyons. Matthew Lyons is an anti-fascist writer, and he does a lot of analysis. He writes for a blog called Three-Way Fight. If you read It's Going Down, you've probably seen a couple articles reposted. Matthew Lyons has been writing for a long time about anti-fascism, the far right, and white supremacy in general. We're really excited to have Matthew on the show today to talk about these issues, especially as Trump is going to be elected, going to be put into office in the inauguration later this week. So we wanted to really sit down with Matt and talk about the far right, about Trump, about fascism, about what all this stuff means. So we're going to just get right into it. So Matt, maybe if you could just introduce yourself a little bit and tell people about kind of the work you've been doing over the last couple of years.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. As you said, I write primarily for 3-Way Fight the Block. The idea of 3-Way Fight is that there are more than two poles of political struggle, that there is the left and there is the kind of the ruling class or the established forces that we often think of as the right. But then there are these insurgent forces, more or less defined as fascist or fascistic. And those are not necessarily on the same side as the folks in power. And so a lot of my work has been to address that complexity and to analyze and bring light to the insurgent right-wing forces without playing into the idea that this is some kind of struggle between fascism and democracy, and that we also need to be critical of the established order and even of some of the anti-fascist initiatives that the state pursues and that liberals support, which often have dangerous implications for the left.
Great. Well, thanks for the introduction. We'll just get into it. A lot of people would say, even with Trump coming into power, just, why should they care about white nationalism? Why should they care about fascism? A lot of people would say, why should they care about some idiot making a meme in his mom's basement? The alt-right in many ways seems very laughable, or even the far right seems very small, especially when compared to, what the state wants to do. So why should we care about what you call the insurgent far right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, it's a fair question. I mean, if you look at, just the human suffering in the world, I mean, there's far more that's coming from, just the economic and other systems of oppression. So, yeah, what is the issue here? I see it in a few sort of a few elements. I mean, one thing is that the small as it is, the far right in its various forms does have the capacity to inflict real direct harm, whether that's through physical attacks that we see in various places, and that certainly have had there's been an upsurge since Trump's victory in November, or the kind of online harassment that many alt-rightists have specialized in, which has really brought real pain and trauma to people who've been targeted. I mean, going back to the Gamergate controversy of a couple of years ago, which involved a lot of male supremacist activists who've since become involved in the alt-right. I mean, a number of women who were targeted by online harassment were forced to leave their homes because of fear for their safety. So there's that kind of direct harm. I think a larger issue is that forces such as the alt-right and other far-right currents have a lot of interactions with larger and more mainstream political forces. And, this has been true for decades. I think back to the early 90s when David Duke, who's often remembered as a former Ku Klux Klan leader, but was a neo-Nazi before he was a Klan leader.
Right.
He got elected to the Louisiana State Legislature and then made a very strong showing in a run for governor of Louisiana. Although he was defeated, he got a majority of the white vote. So that, you know, basically running on his record as a fascist. Pat Buchanan, a couple of years later, ran in the Republican presidential primaries and very explicitly said that he was modeling a lot of his program after what Duke had done. So there's a way that these kind of, you know, quote unquote, fringe political figures can have a real impact on, you know, a much larger stage, even than, you know, beyond their direct impact. And then certainly the kind of relationship that the alt-right had with the Trump presidential campaign in 2015, 2016. I mean, that's a very striking example of this. The kinds of online activism that the alt-right has specialized in, with the use of very skillful memes, as well as online harassment of people, both of those were put very directly in service of the Trump candidacy in the period leading up to the first Republican presidential debate. You saw the cuckservative meme get a lot of attention. And this was a meme that was designed to harass and discredit and humiliate mainstream conservatives, and very specifically in order to help Trump. And it did. And, you know, there have been a number of examples where the alt-right forces, you know, small as they are, have played that kind of role. And it's, you know, certainly been a symbiotic relationship, because in various ways, Trump has also helped them. You know, as far as the potential for relatively small, supposedly fringe political force to have a bigger impact, I mean, I think it's an important example. If I could just mention one other dimension, actually, sure. In terms of why these kind of forces matter, there is also at various points, we've seen a very poisonous kind of relationship between far rightists and some elements of the left, where some elements of far right politics have essentially infected segments of the left, whether it's conspiracy theories, anti-elite conspiracy theories of various kinds, which often trace back to anti-Semitism, although they're, you know, not necessarily phrased that way specifically explicitly in terms of Jews, but have their origins in that. That kind of distorted anti-elitism has gotten picked up by various leftist forces. And at the current moment, I think foreign policy questions are points where you see a real convergence between the alt-right and other white nationalist forces, which are many of them very supportive of Vladimir Putin and supportive of the Assad government in Syria. A lot of what they say sounds very similar to what you see coming from Stalinist the forces within the left, who have this very unfortunate idea that anybody who opposes U.S. interests internationally, or claims to oppose U.S. interests internationally, is anti-imperialist and therefore something to be defended,
right.
Which I think is just a complete distortion of, you know, international politics at this time. But there's just very striking parallels, at least, and I think that's something to look out for, that there may in the future be more active convergence and collaboration there.
Right. Well, you brought up the media. I think a lot of people are surprised about the amount of airtime that the far right and the alt-right has gotten in this election cycle and beyond. I think that seems to be kind of waning right now, and I think actually the media is starting to turn, and now they're talking more just about like how the alt-right is like coming apart, or just who these people are. You know, in the last couple of days, there's been a couple articles that have come out about Mike Enoch. I can't remember his actual name, but basically,
kind of it.
Yeah, exposing the people behind the Right Stuff podcast network. And apparently Mike's wife is part Jewish, so the seams are kind of coming apart in Nazi land. But can you explain this kind of like media spotlight? How would you explain it? And what is driving somebody like, for instance, Richard Spencer to get so much airtime? Why people just, I think a lot of people can't understand why the media feels this compulsion to kind of like pass the mic to these people. Is this something we've seen in the past, or is this something new, or how would you explain it?
Well, I don't know that I have any, you know, deep insights into it. I mean, I think that, I mean, to some extent, it's a reflection of just the effectiveness and the skill with which alt-rightists have manipulated social media and gotten attention to the various memes that they've promoted, such as Cuckservative, in the week before the election, there was the Draft Our Daughters meme, which was the series of fake Hillary Clinton ads claiming that women should join the military in order to go to war against Russia. This was a campaign that was developed and promoted by various alt-rightists. These things are, they're very dramatic, and they're attention grabbing, and the media likes that. They want to get people's attention, and so to some extent, I think it's just a matter of playing to audiences and latching on to things that are getting attention. That's certainly been strengthened by the fact that you had forces like Breitbart News, which was not initially associated with the alt-right at all, but then started to cover them and covered them in a way that was, kind of laudatory and kind of trivializing the white nationalist and other kind of really hardline elements of their politics, so that Breitbart then became kind of a conduit, which I think made it easier for more moderate media organs to pick up the story and go with it. So I think that's part of it. As far as somebody like Richard Spencer goes specifically, part of it is that, he is a journalist, but fundamentally, that's his background. He was, he had editorial positions with the American Conservative and Takis Magazine before launching his own online publication, thealternativeright.com, which then kind of helped to give definition and kind of a focal point to this developing current of white nationalists and male supremacists and sort of, people from the paleoconservative movement and from the libertarian movement and others who were sort of converging around their shared hostility to mainstream conservatism around about 2010 or so. He was the lead editor for that, and so he brings a certain level of just professional expertise of as a media person himself, and may be given that background, maybe somebody who other media people feel more comfortable speaking with because they, speak the same language to an extent.
Right. Yeah. It's going down, gets a lot of media requests. And I was actually talking to somebody from Vice a couple days ago. And the way they explained it was that while we've promoted the idea that if you're, a white nationalist or, a racist essentially, then basically you're just a poor white person that's uneducated and, that's why you're that way. And that essentially these people are fairly well to do and usually well off and look very nice. So they don't play into our narrative and then they become interesting because of that. And I think, obviously that's just, there's a lot wrong with that. Obviously these are systems of power.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
There's these systems of power and it's not because somebody's uneducated that they join, some movement per se. Obviously there's, across time, there's been people that don't fit into that, either neo-Nazi skinhead narrative or Ku Klux Klan or whatever. David Duke, you brought up before, is a really good example. But, I think it's very interesting. And, as we argued, I don't think that anti-fascists can really expect the same spotlight in return, because I don't think we have a message that the media is any way interested in listening to.
Well, I think it's definitely harder. I think there's, there's obviously things that we can do that will help to get the message out, but I agree that it's more of an uphill battle for sure.
Right. Yeah, I just, I don't know if a classless and stateless society sells as much as, we should really re-strengthen patriarchy and white supremacy. But let's move on. You wrote before that populism is a key part of fascism, especially in the United States. Can you explain this? How does populism fit into this?
Sure. Populism in as I understand it, populism in the broadest sense means a political initiative that attempts to rally the people, and the people can mean different things, but rally the people around some form of anti-elitism. And this can take many different forms, some on the more left end of the spectrum, certainly, but many on the more right end of the spectrum. And right-wing populism, in my conception of it, is another element, which is that it's an attempt not only to rally the people against elites, but also to target socially oppressed or marginalized groups who are seen as somehow in league with the elites. And this is a theme that's recurred many times in U.S. history, really going back to the colonial period, but the Jacksonians in the 1820s, 1830s and onward were kind of a classical example of it, where you had Andrew Jackson, who helped to create the Democratic Party, which, is still the same party we have today under that name.
Right.
On one hand, this notion of raising up the common man, which, for example, included abolishing property requirements for voting for white men. Before that, in many states, you had to own a certain amount of property in order to vote. And the Jacksonian said, you know, well, let's get rid of that. And also targeting some kind of visible examples of elite power, most famously the National Bank, which they helped to abolish. This was kind of an early forerunner of the Federal Reserve. But that was coupled with...
Which didn't go over very well, from what I understand, right?
Well, I mean, they did succeed in abolishing the National Bank, which in effect meant that greater financial power then passed to state banks and to private banks. It's been described by some historians as something that helped to increase the dominance, the economic dominance of New York City, because the National Bank was located in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of pushed Philadelphia off the center stage. So it didn't in any way dismantle elite power, but kind of reconfigured it.
Right.
But this kind of very selective or symbolic anti-elitism was combined with an intensification of racial oppression, intensified program of forced displacement of American Indians, most notoriously the Trail of Tears, the mass uprooting of the Cherokee Nation from the southeastern U.S. and, you know, forcing them to walk thousands of miles or hundreds of thousands of miles out to Oklahoma, which cost many lives, as well as intensified defense of slavery, attacks on abolitionists, and so on. So that's all, that kind of package was a, you know, classic example of right-wing populism. And that, as I say, that dynamic has recurred repeatedly through U.S. history.
I was just going to say, I mean, you can draw a line from that to today, where you have like this kind of really skewed, you know, concept of globalism, and that, you know, there are these elites that want to, like, you know, make everything the same, and that, you know, the fight of, you know, the far right is to, you know, preserve American interests and American nationalism, or, you know, on the racist right, you know, the white race or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the notion of global elites or globalist elites is a very common version of anti-elitism in right-wing circles today. And it kind of bleeds into various anti-Jewish conspiracy theories, although it's certainly not the case that everybody who talks about globalist elites is intentionally promoting anti-Semitism. It's just there's a lot of overlap there. But how this relates to fascism is, in my concept of fascism, you have certainly this element, a central element of right-wing populism, in that fascist political forces, fascist movements seek to, again, rally the people around some kind of anti-elitism and around targeting of out-groups or oppressed groups that they see as threatening. And the difference element that sets this apart from other forms of right-wing populism is that fascists in terms of the current U.S. Political context are fundamentally opposed to the existing political system, and they want to replace it with a different kind of political order that's based on a authoritarian model that's in most cases based on a model of racial hierarchy, racial nationalism. Although there are, I would argue, versions of fascism that aren't necessarily about race. I mean, I would argue that some hardline elements within the Christian right would want to set up, you know, want to replace the U.S. political order with a theocracy based on their interpretation of biblical law, that those represent a kind of fascism as well. And they certainly often draw on white supremacist themes, but that's not kind of the centerpiece or the core basis for their ideology. That's more of a bit of a secondary thing.
Right. I just think it's for some people, it's hard for them to wrap their brain around, you know, Trump talking about the elites. And I mean, you know, he says this, you know, this is about, you know, confronting the elites. And he does say the globalists at times. You know, there was that famous ad they put out that was, you know, targeting like the international bankers and like Goldman Sachs. But then, you know, he turns around and hires people that used to work at Goldman Sachs. I mean, he's got over 6 billionaires, you know, in his administration right now. He's bringing in his son-in-law, who's a billionaire, to, you know, help run the country with him. I mean, Steve Bannon, the former, head person at Breitbart, is now his top advisor. It seems a hard, I hate to say it, pill to swallow, but you know, that he can talk about elitism, but yet, I mean, what is Trump but, you know, this elite head of financial speculative real estate capital?
Yeah. I think on one level, you could see it as just simple hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more to it than that, because
right.
if that's all it was, then, you know, why would anybody take him seriously? And clearly many people do take him seriously, or he wouldn't be where he is now. This kind of contradiction isn't new. I mean, I think of somebody like Henry Ford, who, you know, was, you know, in the early 20th century, you know, one of the most powerful capitalists in the world, who, you know, helped to create the kind of mass production industrial economy that, you know, we think of, auto production, Detroit, and so on. But, you know, it went far beyond that. I mean, he was also somebody who had a major role in promoting anti-Semitism as an ideology within the U.S. and internationally. I mean, the German Nazis looked to his work as influential and something that they admired. But a big element of that kind of anti-Semitism, that propaganda, was this idea that, you know, Jews are this powerful conspiratorial group that are exercising power behind the scenes. And, he talked about himself as a worker in some of his writings, and sort of made this case that, yes, he was a capitalist, but he had really more in common, supposedly, with the people who worked in his factories than with the bankers, who were the ones who really held the power.
Right.
And, you know, why do people go along with this? I mean, I think, to some extent, people are desperate for to hear somebody on a national stage saying things that speak to their own sense of disempowerment, that speak to their sense of grievance. And somebody who doesn't look like a regular politician, somebody who doesn't sound like, you know, the kind of polished people, mostly men, who tend to hold power in Washington. That there's that kind of sort of cultural appeal, I think, is part of it. And I think that, I mean, as you know, going back to the Andrew Jackson example, but many others, part of what right-wing anti-elitism often is about on one level is it provides an expression or a channel, a focal point for conflicts within the ruling class. It may be about factional divisions over particular policies that benefit some capitalists more than others, or for example, historically, for many decades, the dominant faction of the business community in the United States has advocated free trade, or at least lessening trade barriers. But there has also been a faction that has opposed this because their particular industries benefit from tariff barriers. So I think it's a little early to say exactly what kind of factional tensions are going on and sort of how those are how those are fueling or feeding into what Trump is doing and how he's relating to the rest of the political scene in Washington. But I think it's likely that one way or another, those kinds of tensions are playing a role. And I think it's going to be important to look at that aspect of it in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, and I think that's what's hard for a lot of people to kind of grasp is that, you know, you have all these people running around talking about globalism, but I mean, really what they're talking about is neoliberalism and, you know, the globalization of financial capital. And then you have somebody like Trump comes out, mm-hmm. and basically what he's talking about is American economic nationalism to a certain point. I mean, just like Steve Bannon said, like, look, I'm not a white nationalist and I'm an American economic nationalist. And, I think a lot of people just extrapolate all these political positions from that, but in reality it's like, no, this is a different version of the same system. You know, they want a competing version of, you know, what the Democrats have been selling for the last 8 years, which is this, you know, globalized financial, you know, capitalism.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that a question that I have just looking at what's going on now is whether the Trump administration is going to represent, you know, basically a harsher version of neoliberalism, or whether it may represent some kind of significant departure from that. Not, you know, something that's going to, you know, threaten the capitalist system in any way, but, you know, there are, every few decades, there have been shifts in the U.S. political order where one set of policies or sort of ruling class strategy gives way to another one. I mean, one of those was in the 1930s with the New Deal, where it in place of the kind of laissez-faire capitalism that had been very much in power for, quite a while before that, you had the rise of a more welfare state oriented ideology and system, with the creation of things like Social Security, the National Labor Relations Act, which gave a certain limited acceptance or legitimacy to organized labor, as long as it was willing to, you know, kind of play the game and not be too threatening to capitalist interests. So that was a real shift, and that it was partly about pressure from popular forces, but it was also about conflict within the business community. And then the shift from the New Deal system to what we now think of as neoliberalism was another shift, which took place starting in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter, and then much more so under Ronald Reagan in the 80s and onward from there, where you had then a shift to away from social welfare policies toward deregulating business, toward shifting the tax structure to move wealth on a fairly massive scale, upward toward wealthier people, all these things. That represented shifts and conflicts within the business community, as well as the rise of right wing populist forces that provided a mass base. So all that's to say that I think a real question is whether this is a moment where we're going to see another shift like that. Not something that is going to bring down the system, or even, I don't see it as something that represents fascism in the way that people use that term, but it may represent a real change in strategy, a change in policies that affect the role of government in within U.S. society, as well as the relationship between the United States and other countries, reconfiguration of economic relations, and I think that it may be something that it takes a while to sort out what's going on. The shift from the New Deal system to neoliberalism, it kind of had sort of a couple of fits and starts. Nixon came in 1968 and in some ways shifted away from the old system, but in some ways continued it. And it was sort of a transitional figure. And it really wasn't until later that things kind of clarified themselves. Trump may be a kind of transitional figure in that same sense. I mean, it's hard to reconcile a lot of his rhetoric with a lot of the kind of establishment figures that he's brought in
right.
to his cabinet.
Right.
But, at the same time, I do think that it's too early to say, he's just going to kind of abandon all of the stuff that he's been promoting. And not just been promoting for the last year. I mean, a lot of this is stuff that he's been promoting for a couple of decades.
Right. I mean, I think from our analysis, I mean, if there's one thing, in his 100-day plan that you can point to that like pops out again and again, it's resource extraction, it's, drilling, pipelines and stuff like that. So I think if there's one thing that he could kind of point to and be like, here's our American homegrown, job creation machine, it's, resource extraction. And I think that fits into kind of, puffing out the chest against, you know, these, you know, quote unquote democratic, you know, environmental regulations and restrictions. I mean, you know, the Republican platform now is talking about, you know, getting rid of, you know, parks and stuff and opening them up to, you know, drilling, ranching, all that stuff, which kind of comes out of the militia movements and stuff like that. But I mean, I think that would be one way for him to really say, like, look, like, you know, we've gone up against, you know, the political machine, and we, you know, we have jobs now.
Right. Yeah.
Well, since we're talking about Trump, let's move on a little bit. You know, there's been so much discussion and debate. I mean, obviously on Three-Way Fight, there's been a lot of talk about this, but, you know, basically, like, is Trump a fascist? What does he represent? And, you know, I don't want to, like, spend the rest of our time talking about this, but I think it is important. We're kind of partial to an essay that came out on the CrimeThink website that essentially argues that no, Trump is not a fascist in the classical sense, but he moreover represents, you know, the re-strengthening of white supremacy in American society. And, you know, he's not going to shake up, you know, the political order. He's not going to, like, he's not going to offer a new deal to the working class in exchange for, you know, the creation of fascism. He's not going to call on auxiliary forces to defend the, you know, a new fascist regime. You know, he just represents, you know, the re-strengthening of these old systems of oppression. So I'm just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts? You know, is Trump a fascist? Is he something else? Is this something new? Is this just what would have happened if George Wallace would have won? You know, what is this that we're seeing?
Well, I don't see him as a fascist. So in broad terms, I agree with the CrimeThink article that you're referring to. And it, I mean, the concept of fascism is, it's difficult because, you know, the term gets thrown around a lot, and, you know, particularly in this past year, it's been used a lot. I mean, it's the first time, as far as I know, that you've seen, you know, leading conservative figures labeling the Republican frontrunner a fascist, but you did. But people mean a lot of different things by fascism. And so it's hard to talk about in a way that doesn't quickly kind of, you know, get into kind of arguments about, well, my definition is better, and, you know, this kind of thing. So I think it's useful up to a point, but it also can also be a distraction if it gets in the way of, you know, trying to understand just the actual concrete dynamics of what's going on, whatever we want to call it. But, you know, that said, I mean, I do think that it's important to make a distinction between a political force that is fundamentally rejects the existing political system and wants to create, you know, some other kind of more authoritarian political order, which it, certainly in my view is a key component of fascism. You know, what's, you know, that is different from an initiative that is fundamentally not going to break with the existing system, even if that means continuing the process of expanding the state's repressive apparatus, of expanding its authoritarian tendencies, which has been going on for quite a while. Because I certainly think Trump, is likely to do that. But I don't see him as abolishing the system in favor of something else. And
right.
The Crime Think article emphasizes the issue of, organized paramilitaries and I think that's part of it. I mean, there's a danger in talking about fascism of defining fascism in a way that's limited to something very closely similar to what we saw in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And, I would argue that, fascism is a dynamic current that can take different forms, and that today it's going to take forms that may be very different from that. For example, in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, fascism was all about creating a strong state. I mean, Mussolini celebrated the idea of totalitarianism. I mean, it was seen as a good thing. But the idea of a state that is all-encompassing and that controls every aspect of society in a very centralized manner, I mean, that is, that's what a lot of people associate with fascism, and that's certainly what it meant at that time. I would argue that if you look at political developments within the far right, across a lot of different ideological currents in the U.S. and elsewhere, there's been a major shift, not 100%, but to, a large portion of the far right have shifted toward various kinds of decentralist politics, whether it means breaking up the U.S. into smaller ethno-states, or whether it means the idea coming from Posse Comitatus, which then went into the patriot movement and the militia movement of, mm-hmm. Rejecting the legitimacy of government above the county level, or whether it means the Christian Reconstructionist notion of developing a theocracy that exercises this power through the church and the family and through local governments rather than through some sort of big centralized state. These are all examples of, movements which promote, very anti-democratic and, supremacist ideologies in one way or another, but they're not about creating a strong state in the classical sense. So do we call those fascist? Or, having fascist tendencies, or is it something fundamentally different?
Right.
I have my ideas about that. Other people may disagree. And on a certain level, it doesn't matter as long as we're clear on what they represent. If you want to call them one thing and somebody else wants to call them something else, that's a secondary matter in a certain sense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. I mean, some people were kind of laughing at the latest RCP front group, running around saying resist fascism. But, in a certain sense, I totally agree with you. Like, who cares at this point what they're calling it? Let's actually do something about it. Well, I wanted to ask you next, going into Trump taking office, what does that mean for the far right? Are they going to lose some of their juice behind them now that they, now that a lot of the insurgent base is kind of pacified? Do you see Trump calling on, auxiliary forces to get certain things done? Do you see them more holding, his feet to the fire kind of and trying to get him to pass certain things, build the wall, et cetera, et cetera? What do you see the far right doing in the next period? And also looking at the inauguration, we're seeing like a lot of groups like Bikers for Trump. I know the Oath Keepers are coming out. It's going to be, I think, the inauguration in a lot of ways will kind of show us, how this is going to roll out. But I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, it's a little hard to predict, but I mean, talking about the alt-right specifically for a moment, you know, the alt-right, you know, as I discussed earlier, developed this kind of symbiotic relationship with the Trump campaign. And not all alt-rightists supported Trump, but certainly a majority did. And at the same time, they were very clear that he did not share their politics, that he was not working to bring about the kind of changes that they see as ultimately necessary and valuable, which in most cases means, among other things, as I said, breaking up the United States into multiple ethno states. You know, they're really big on, you know, white people having their own state, although there are other versions within the alt-right as well. But, you know, they said, okay, Trump doesn't want that, and he's not going to bring that about, but he's going to help create more space for us. He's going to create openings. he's going to make it he's going to help protect us against, you know, supposed leftist repression, this kind of thing. So they saw him as somebody who was useful. And then, you know, they were very happy when he was elected. But again, not seeing it as like, okay, this is, you know, now we're there. Now we, you know, we can just kind of coast. But rather, yes, we have to hold his feet to the fire, and we have to press for the things that we want, you know, which in some cases are not going to be what Trump wants. I think that there's, I mean, you know, the alt-right right now is in a difficult place because they've had a lot of internal conflict, and then lately, you know, the unmasking of some of their key players who had been anonymous previously and now are no longer anonymous. It's harder for them to function, and there's questions about, you know, how they're going to you know, whether they're going to be able to continue going forward. I think that there's probably going to, at the least, be conflict over the question of how do we relate to a Trump administration. There will be some people who will say, you know, take a hard line that we need to take a, you know, a fairly adversarial role. And others who will say, well, no, we need to, you know, press forward as a kind of, you know, radical wing of the Trump coalition. And, you know, so it's likely that there will be debates about that. And I mean, up to now, I mean, the alt-right has had a lot of internal tensions of one kind or another, but has, for the most part, maintained, you know, a degree of cohesiveness and you know, kind of this notion of a big tent
sure.
ideological approach, which has been very effective. That may continue, or it may be that, you know, no, it's, they're really going to fall apart at this point, and you'll see much more of a fragmented approach. And, you know, as far as other far-right forces, you know, I think to some extent they're in the same kind of position. Groups like Oath Keepers and other Patriot Movement groups generally supported Trump. They like a lot of the things that he stands for, but they don't necessarily see him as representing everything that they want. And I think there's probably going to be some of that, you know, same kind of dynamic of debates about how supportive and how adversarial to be. And that's going to some extent depend on what kind of specific policies and programs he's going to put into place. I mean, you talked a little while ago about resource extraction and, you know, turning national parks over to logging companies and oil companies and so on. I mean, there are certainly people associated with the Patriot Movement who would really like that. You know, the people who, you know, rallied around the Bundy family in Nevada, which was advocating for, you know, greater access to public lands for ranchers. You know, they have this idea that the people, quote unquote, are going to benefit if, you know, we dismantle these restrictions on uses of public lands, that somehow that's going to trickle down to, you know, people besides the logging companies and the oil companies. You know, they may be happy with the results, or they may start to say, well, actually, we're not benefiting from this. Or, right. you know, the more elite stratum of the movement, the Patriot Movement, is benefiting, but the, you know, the folks lower down the economic scale are not. And so they may have an internal falling out along those lines.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see, you know, it seems like across the board, at least on, you know, the white nationalist neo-Nazi side of things, you know, the Daily Stormer, Traditionalist Worker Party, I mean, they all basically said, like, wow, it would have been really better if Clinton would have won, because then we would have had four more years of, you know, very clearly pointing to Clinton and being like, there's your enemy, and using that as kind of a rallying cry to build a base. And now, you know, that conversation has kind of been lost. And it seems like there's really kind of a lack of strategy or discussion on their end. And yeah, I think it's going to be a lot harder for them. I mean, people like Richard Spencer, it seems like Richard Spencer wants to go out and, you know, recreate, you know, the Liberty Lobby. He wants to move the National Policy Institute to Washington, D.C. and, you know, create this thing that basically lobbies and tries to influence the Trump regime. You know, how successful that will be, I think, you know, will be anybody's guess. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting. I'm really curious if you think that, like, for instance, I don't know, if Trump, you know, really tries to go ahead with creating a Muslim registry, or if they're going to, if he's going to try to out the number of deportations that Obama did, you know, if he will in turn, like, you know, essentially kind of call on, you know, these far right forces to kind of back him up, or like, will that play out in the streets? You know, if our side, you know, goes out and fights, you know, will they show up? I mean, that certainly seems to be how the inauguration is planning out, where it seems like a lot of the, not even necessarily ideological, but like I said, you know, bikers for Trump, or just, you know, general Trump supporters, it seem kind of itching for a fight against anybody that wants to come out and protest.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it might even be that Trump doesn't even matter, but he's just kind of the window dressings of some, you know, some larger things at hand, or that are playing out.
Well, yeah, I think it's hard to know how it's going to develop, and I mean I doubt that. I would be surprised if Trump has a clear idea of how he wants to move forward. I mean, he didn't expect to be elected more than anybody else expected him to be elected.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, We're getting to the end here, but I wanted to last ask a couple more questions. You know, one of the essays that you wrote on Three-Way Fight that I really, really enjoyed and I really encourage everybody to write is you wrote an article about the Oath Keepers when they went to Ferguson. This was around the time, I think, that the police officer, Darren Wilson, that killed Michael Brown Jr. was sentenced, and the Oath Keepers came out to, you know, in their words, you know, stop rioting and looting and basically be an auxiliary force to the police, and they were on top of rooftops with high-powered rifles to, like, stop rioting and all this stuff. And you know, after a couple of days, I think they got told to go home. But at some point, some of the Oath Keepers actually had a change of heart to some degree, and they were saying, like, well, we should actually be encouraging people in the community to arm themselves and to, you know, display their Second Amendment rights. And they wanted to, like, organize a march in the town of Ferguson, you know, with the largely black residents, you know, an armed march, basically, like, showing their rights in the face of the police. And this caused an internal tension. And I'm curious, within the Oath Keepers, and I don't think much came of it. It seems like a lot of people just, some of them left the organization because of that. But I'm curious if you can see any other things like that in the coming period that kind of, like, split the... Sorry.
That was my end. Sorry about that.
That's okay. They kind of, like, split the right. And this is, like, some groups like Phoenix Class War Council have talked about doing this, but kind of, like, picking these things, like, within the right and, you know, kind of holding their feet to the fire on these issues. Like, oh, you supposedly support people's Second Amendment rights. You know, where are you in the face of this egregious, like, police violence? But is there anything else you see like that that could be an opportunity to kind of, like, break these groups apart or split them down the middle based on their own internal contradictions?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we could have a whole discussion about the Patriot Movement's race politics, which is kind of the background for that piece. And I would encourage people to, you know, see what I wrote there for kind of some of that background. But I mean, in brief, I mean, people have this idea that the Patriot Movement is basically all about coded white nationalism. And I don't think that's really accurate. I mean, I think there's clearly white nationalist folks have played a significant role within the movement. But there's more to it than that. And part of it is that the kind of the common denominator of that movement has been, you know, much more about, it's been about gun rights. It's been about, you know, defense against tyranny. And I would argue that it kind of comes down to a kind of, individualism, you know, this sort of this notion of, you know, getting government off my back and this kind of thing, which often, goes along with white nationalism, but can also take other forms. And I think that's part of what was going on with the, internal debate over Ferguson, you know, the Oath Keepers internal debate, that you had a majority within the, you know, or at least within the leadership and within the Patriot Movement more broadly that, you know, was kind of horrified by Black Lives Matter and you know, just the notion of people of color, you know, defending themselves. But then there was also a minority faction that said, well, hold on, you know, if we're talking about defense against tyranny and people protecting themselves with guns, then, you know, how can we not support these people? Mm-hmm. That tension, has actually been part of the Patriot Movement for over 20 years in one form or another. And it is still there. I mean, if you look at the Oath Keepers website, you know, you look at the videos that they have of, you know, who their people are, you know, you see black and brown faces, and that's not by accident. I mean, they want to present themselves as quote unquote colorblind. And we can talk about colorblindness as an oppressive ideology that masks, you know, the realities of racial oppression and white supremacy. And that's certainly the case, but it's a very different kind of ideology than, you know, what you hear from, you know, Richard Spencer's of the world. And, you know, so there is some vulnerability there in terms of there are contradictions that can be highlighted and that can be promoted. You know, so I think that's the case. As far as the alt-right goes, I mean, there are conflicts over Jews. You know, is the alt-right about, you know, just eliminating Jews altogether as just this scourge, or is it about, you know, making some sort of accommodation with right-wing Zionists in hopes that they will attract Jews to leave and, you know, go to Israel and everybody will be happy. You know, those are two forms of anti-Semitism that have very different policy implications. And both of them are represented within the alt-right. Mm-hmm. There's also conflicts within the alt-right over homosexuality and homophobia. You know, you have, you know, certainly widespread, you know, hatred and contempt toward gays and lesbians, but you also have some significant figures within the alt-right who are themselves gay or who are, you know, welcoming to gay politics on the grounds that, you know, it's a way to kind of, you know, we can use Islamophobia, for example, to recruit gay supporters, you know, on the, you know, claiming that, you know, because the Islamic State is, you know, virulently homophobic organization, therefore, you know, if you're gay, you should support a Muslim registry. I mean, this kind of thing. But again, there's tensions there, and you know, where there's tensions, there's the potential to highlight contradictions and conflicts.
Okay, thanks a lot. Once again, we've been talking with Matthew Lyons. Matthew's a longtime anti-fascist writer. Check out his writings at Three Way Fight. And Matthew, if there's anything else you want to throw out there, we actually have a booklet that's going to come out soon, that's going to be distributed by AK Press, that's going to have one of your essays, if you want to talk about that, and also an essay from It's Going Down, and one more, I believe. So look out for that soon. If there's anything else you want to discuss in this time, or anything else you want to bring up.
Yeah, sure. Just the booklet that you're referring to is it's being published by Kersplebedeb Publishing, which is a little leftist publishing house up in Montreal. And the title is Control Alt Delete, an anti-fascist report about the alternative right. And as you say, it's got an essay by me. It has a piece from It's Going Down, and it has a piece called Notes on Trump by Broma, who is a longtime leftist writer, the essay by me is also going to be available through Political Research Associates in online form, and so I would encourage people also to check out the Political Research Associates website, which has, you know, a number of other valuable resources.
And do you have any books out
as well?
Do you have any books, Matthew, or any other resources besides Three Way Fight that you can direct people to read your stuff? Because we do really want to encourage people to go to Three Way Fight. But if you have any other things out, I know, like you brought up PRA, Political Research Associates, you have some essays there. Is there anywhere else that you have some of your work?
Well, I co-authored the book Right Wing Populism in America along with Chip Berle, which was published in 2000. It's published by Guilford Press. And it is, I believe, still in print, although I hear that it's on back order. I believe there is an ebook version that is available. So I would encourage people to go to Guilford Press and take a look. I mean, that came out, you know, 16, 17 years ago, but, you know, a lot of the dynamics that we described there are, you know, I think exactly what we're seeing now, just in a different form.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, just in closing, you know, this will probably come out right before the inauguration. There's going to be protests and demonstrations and confrontations across the U.S. In closing, do you have any final thoughts for people that might be headed out the door to take part in those mobilizations?
Well, this is a really bleak time, and I hope that we can all support each other in being critical, in taking a militant stance, and that this is something that it's not a short-term struggle. I mean, there's a battle right now, but it's going to go on for a long time. And I encourage people to get to know what is going on, whether it's these readings we've talked about or just the many other good analyses that are out there, try to understand what the dynamics are, as well as go out and protest and organize with people. Those things need to go hand in hand.
Yeah, we completely agree. Well, thanks again, Matthew Lyons, for joining us, and check out Three Way Fight. And thanks so much, and take care, Matt.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Rihanna. Good girl going bad. Take three. Action. No clouds in my stones. Let it rain. I hide the plane in the bank. Coming down like a Dow Jones. When the clouds come, we gone. We Rockefellers. We fly higher than weather. And she vibes are better. You know me. In anticipation for precipitation, stack chips with a rainy day. Jay, Rain Man is back with Little Miss Sunshine. Rihanna, where you at?
You have my heart, and we'll never be worlds apart. Maybe in magazines, but you still be my star. Baby, cause in the dark, you can't see shiny cars. And that's when you need me there. With you, I'll always share. Took a no thumbs to get out to the end. Now that it's raining more than ever, know that we'll still have each other. You can stand under my umbrella. You can stand under my umbrella. Ella, ella, eh, eh, eh. Under my umbrella. Ella, ella, eh, eh, eh. Under my umbrella. Ella, ella, eh, eh, eh. Under my. Together we'll mend your heart. Because when the sunshine will shine together, told you I'll be here forever. Said I'll always be your friend. Took an old promise to get out to the end.
stand under my umbrella. La, la, eh, 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 eh.
Come in.